This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. Get involved with the debate by tweeting at Blue Moon Podcast and check out exclusive interviews on bluemoonpodcast.com. It's your club and this is your show.
The excitement of football fans can never be underestimated, but let's be honest, there's nothing more exciting than a new look team at the beginning of a new season to get us all going. Welcome to this week's lockdown special of the Blue Moon Podcast, where we're going back to a season where things couldn't have been more exciting when they started. After only 10 home league goals the year before, uninspiring tactics and a dull mid-table finish, things were looking up when a new owner and a new manager came into the club in the shape of Taksin Sinawatra and Sven-Goran Eriksson. Yes, we're going back to August 2007. I'm your host, David Mooney, and with me this week is the man behind the numbers at Stat City, Adam Carter.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Good to hear. Right, well, we've done a couple of one-season specials now, one where it was a full 12 months of hope and one where it was a full 12 months of despair. So let's combine the two and head back to August 2007. This was a time when the worldwide banking crisis was in its very, very early stages. The beginnings of the subprime mortgage defaults were happening in America. New to the big screen in the UK was The Bourne Ultimatum, Superbad and High School Musical 2. And this is what we were listening to in the charts. I don't know about you, but R&B's got a lot to answer for, hasn't it?
A golden era in music, I'm saying, a golden era.
I went back looking through the chart and all I could see was it's just R&B everywhere.
Yeah, it definitely took over around that time.
Right, well, let's talk City from 2007, because City had gone through some changes that summer. Out had gone previous chairman John Wardle, and the club had been sold to the controversial Taksin Sinawatra. Stuart Pearce was sacked as manager. Sven-Goran Eriksson was appointed in his place. What were you thinking about the changes that were being made?
I think it was the right decision. Obviously, we were really excited by Taksin's takeover. Obviously, it was pre-Mansour, so that was the first we'd had, certainly in our supporting lifetime, of a what was perceived as a takeover then. Obviously, we'd seen what Sven had done with the England team. He'd endeared himself to the nation. So when we're getting someone of Sven's calibre after a horrendous season under Pearce, you know, we there was optimism. The season DVD was called The Sven Revolution. It really did feel like we were on a upward trajectory at the start of that season. We brought in 8 new players and it was a real fresh, vibrant atmosphere going into that campaign.
Did you ever at any point feel like the takeover wasn't going to happen? Because it was talked about for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it took until the start of July to actually go through and happen.
Yeah, and I remember there was some reports of dodgy dealings, which were been well documented certainly since, about the then owner. And it was certainly protracted takeover dealings that took forever, and we're thinking, are we just going to be nearly men again? And but once it went through, that, like you say, that excitement certainly took hold then. But there was a fear, obviously, in that summer that it was going to be so near yet so far.
Sven felt like a step up as well, didn't he?
Yeah, like I say, he had that international calibre. He was a different level of manager that we'd been able to attract. And I really thought he was, he'd endeared himself with the national team fans, and I really thought he was certainly a step up of what and was going to take us places.
Well, to give you an idea of the side that he inherited when he was taken over, in his entire tenure, Stuart Pearce spent £11.5 million at City. That was at the same time as recouping £24.5 million. Most of that was on Sean Wright Phillips, to be fair. But he brought in £21.5 million. So for the net spend geeks out there, he made a net profit of about £13 million. And on the squad, it showed. They were, like, with the new investment... Okay, alleged new investment. We'll come on to that a bit later on. Sven was able to spend more than £50 million in his only season at the club. So, I mean, just going back to a previous podcast, this is what Rob Pollard said on a previous episode about that summer a few years ago.
He did a trolley dash around Europe in the space of about 5 minutes and brought a load of players we didn't know in, and they were all right.
And that pretty much sums it up, Adam. It was a trolley dash around Europe, kind of like a last-minute thing. Look at the signings. The first one was the 13th of July, Rolando Bianchi, 8.8 million. The last one was the 3rd of August, Valery Boyanov, 5.75 million. That's what, 21 days?
It was open season. There was comments, even Sven said himself, that in the first training session, the players didn't know each other's name for the first game even. That's just absolute haphazard planning. Well, no planning by the looks of it. There was a feature on Match of the Day after that first game where City fans were being shown pictures of our new signings outside the ground and having to identify them. We were quite a laughing stock in terms of how the signing approach had been made. Sven was quite defendant in his post-match interview after that because people had said that he'd only seen them on YouTube, on videos, and he'd never actually didn't even know the players.
Well, I'm going to stop you there because it's 2007 and he definitely hadn't seen them on YouTube because YouTube was 18 months old at that stage.
Well, we need to sack the journos on that one. Well, certainly on video. Sven never really got rattled too much in his post-match interviews, but I remember that one standing out. He was actually saying if they want to be stupid and write that, they can. But I'm not 100% sure how truthful he's been in the fact that he knew those players.
Yeah.
I certainly only knew a handful.
I didn't know any. I'm not going to lie, I didn't know any. Listen to the names, okay? Rolando Bianchi, 8.8 million. Gelson Fernandez, 4.2 million. Giovanni was free. Martin Petrov, 4.7 million. They were the July signings. And then there was that wonderful press conference where they announced Vedran Čorluka, Alano, Javier Garrido, and Valery Boyanov all in one go.
Yeah, it's quite a famous picture, that one.
Yeah, it's a fantastic picture, just because they all signed on the 2nd and 3rd of August. So it was like, it was honestly rattled through the transfers.
I didn't know any of those on that day. It was the Martin Petrov one that was kind of the big marquee signing for me. You know, he was probably the most well-known name there. But it was certainly, it was just mad. We'd never done anything like that, you know, previously in terms of that all-in-one, just scattergun approach. And that gave us a kind of an insight into what we could expect from the rest of that season. Because I think we had a mad January as well after that did Benjani join?
It was Benjani and Caicedo. Well, we'll come on to that a bit later on. Yeah. Like, what did you think of that new look City? That game at West Ham was obviously eagerly anticipated. But before that game came along, what were you thinking about this new team?
Had we lost Distan that summer?
Yeah, he'd gone
that
summer. Yeah. My cutting thing was that Nicky Weaver had gone. He was my hero.
So we started the season with Schmeichel and Hart, if I remember.
Yeah. Andres Isaksson as well.
Yeah. And so we had those three. And like I say, I was your gutted Weaver went. Distan going was a big knock for me. I just thought we wouldn't have had that protection. So we moved Mika Richards in from right back to centre back to partner Richard Dunn in Distan's absence. It was a kind of there was still an optimism because of the new management structure, and obviously this you've got to hope that out of these 8-9 players that came in, one of them is going to be decent enough to move us forward after what we'd experienced the year before.
Well, we spoke to Sven a few years ago, so let's hear what he had to say about getting the new players in. Here he is speaking to the podcast back in about 2011, explaining why he needed so many new faces.
I knew that they had a poor season the season before, and I think the players and everyone in the club understood that it was necessary to take in some new players. In other way, the situation could have been struggling for relegation. And nobody wanted to do that, of course. And the owners at that time, they were aware of it as well.
Was it difficult to get so many players to gel in such a quick time?
Yeah, of course it was difficult. It was difficult to get them. And we did it in rather short time. And I think we were lucky because more or less all of the players we took in made a good contribution to the team and to the results we did. I think that's my fault. We missed only one, which didn't fit in as well as I thought he would have done. That was Bianchi. But all the others, I think they did an extremely good job for the club.
For a pledge of $2 a month, you can hear our weekly bonus show on a wide range of City topics. There's more details on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
So that was Fenn chatting to us back in 2011. Was there any name that you were most excited to see out of the new players, Adam, or was it a case of, I just want to see this new team?
Yeah, so obviously Petrov I knew of. And then there was a pre-season game against Valencia where Alano had had a few good touches, and I'm thinking, oh, and David Silva played in that game. I was thinking, oh, maybe he could spark us into life, because we didn't really have anything like that midfield creativity at that time. So I thought he was going to be the one that would unlock it, and he was one I was pinning my hopes on. And I was a real big fan of Alano, but I'm not sure everyone echoes that sentiment.
You mentioned David Silva. That was the day he scored his first goal at the Etihad.
Yep.
He scored the winner.
Little brain teaser.
Scored the winner for Valencia that day. The one I was excited to see was Valery Boyanov. And then he just, because he embodied everything that I wanted in a centre forward. He looked big and tough and strong. And he only played a handful of games, but he looked like he could finish as well.
Yeah, I remember them lot over the road obviously had Rooney at that time, and a big, strong centre forward. And he was in his home country, was referred to as their Wayne Rooney. So I thought, oh, we might have someone who can match that now, up for a bit of a presence up front. And in fleeting glances, he looked great. There was a good goal away at Spurs that it scored. We had a bit of presence up front. And I thought, yeah, maybe we will now have something about us up top as well under Bodjanov. He certainly looked a presence, a physical presence.
Just a shame. Just a shame what happened to him, really. Yeah. Barry Ternan on Twitter asks, whatever happened to Rolando Bianchi? And I did a bit of digging because, like, he was one that he came in. He showed a lot of promise in the first half of the season, but there were stories behind the scenes that he was homesick. And his career kind of backs that up, because after half a season at City, he went on loan to Lazio, so obviously back to Italy. City then sold him to Torino in Italy. He stayed in Italy for all but 16 games of the rest of his career, where he played 16 games with Mallorca in Spain. So I think when it comes to homesickness and something like that, you just can't really help it, can you?
Yeah, I liked Bianchi. I thought he
was a bit slow, but I thought he was all right. Yeah,
he was a typical like a typical Italian striker in terms, not on the Baggio levels, of course, but just he gave us something different again. He seemed to always pop up with a 6-yard tap in if he did score for us. He was certainly a bit of a back post poacher, but he seemed to want to do well for us. He's still got affinity to City now, if you see his tweets and stuff whenever we do well. So he obviously did take something from the experience. You can't account for homesickness. And when you throw in so many players into a new team at once, there's not going to be that gelling culture. And you've obviously not got enough time to assess what his mentality is going to be like. I know City now, in their transfer approach, they analyse a player for 12, 18 months to see what type of personality they've got, how strong the mentality is, and what the character's like.
You can't do that in 10 minutes, can you?
Yeah, Sven definitely didn't do that on his video.
Yeah. Richard Dunn spoke to the Irish sports radio station Off the Ball a few years ago. This is about the impact that Sven had at City.
He was genuinely such a nice fella that he expects it. If you don't give it to him, well, then good boy.
I feel like nice fellas get taken advantage of by footballers.
But for him, he just, all right, that's fine. If you don't want to be part of this, you don't want to behave in the correct manner, well, then you're not going to come and represent the club that I'm leading.
Okay. So he'd be ruthless in that way.
Yeah, and the reason why we all liked him, on our first pre-season, within days of him taking over, he took us to Sweden and brought us all down for dinner and said, right, Richard, you're the captain, here's some tokens, go and take the lads out for a couple of beers, blah, blah, blah. Be back at 12 o'clock. So we were a little bit delayed. We never got back till about 1 o'clock, I think.
Have footballers ever made a curfew? Not one story has finished with, and we all got home.
But as we came in the door, we were all trying to sneak around corners, and Tord Grip was playing the accordion. We were all singing. So we just thought, oh, these are going to be all right.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast.
So that's Richard Dunn speaking to Off the Ball, and we can probably understand a bit more now about why the players liked him so much. We mentioned before, City started off so well. They opened with a 2-0 win at West Ham. It was followed by a 1-0 win over Derby at Eastlands. That was City's first home goal in 8 months, or about 13 hours of football, and it was scored by Michael Johnson. Yeah, the relief. Yeah. It was Michael Johnson. Here's his goals for that season.
Johnson has all kinds of room. Johnson!
Falling in the city of Manchester Stadium. I wonder if the pitch will get a little bit greasier. Johnson cruising onto that. Oh, lovely run. Johnson! Lovely goal! The new Colin Bell of the city of Manchester Stadium. It's a lofty parallel to make for a young boy, but he certainly reminds me of the great Manchester City midfield player of years gone by.
So that's both of Michael Johnson's goals in the Premier League that season. The second came in a home win over Aston Villa. Sven had found this new mix of foreign talents and kind of academy products because, as you mentioned, Adam, Micah Richards was playing centre-back and had moved inside at that stage. Stephen Ireland was doing well under him. Nedim Manua was in and out the side a fair bit as well. Michael Johnson is the one that stood out, though, isn't he?
Yeah. And when we knew we were doing this season, I said, oh, I'll focus on Michael Johnson. But it's, I think... I'm blinded by homegrown academy players in terms of how they perform. We dug up the stats and they actually weren't as impressive as we thought about Michael Johnson, but he certainly had that drive from midfield. He was a proper box-to-box midfielder. A lot of people compared him to Colin Bell and Paul Lakin, that they were the type of players we'd not seen since a player like him. And you get, you're damn right about Sven mixing that, you know, the foreign players with the homegrown talent, and he did give the homegrown lads a good run in that team, and they provided a bit of grit where Alano or Giovanni may needed a bit more freedom to go and express themselves. But Michael Johnson, what a talent, and it's just, again, we're robbed with injuries, that how often that happens to players where they've got all this potential and we're getting excited and, like, say, putting them in the same sentence as a Colin Bell and a Paul Lake. You're desperate to see them do well every time he got on the ball. I remember watching Michael Johnson, like, he'd probably intercept something on the edge of our box and then join in with some play at the opposition box. And I was like, I've been watching the match, and how did he get there? He just seemed to glide across the pitch.
Glide is very much the word. He moved so well. Yeah. And, like, he fitted in. I mean, he must have been, what, 19 or so, 20 at that time? He was very young. Yeah. And he just fitted in. He looked like a Premier League player, even when... I remember he came in for his debut under Pearce in that god-awful 4-0 defeat at Wigan. But then... Pearce took him out again, and then kind of 6 months later at the end of that season, he'd embedded himself into that team. And alongside Joey Barton, okay, we know what Joey Barton's like, but they were a good midfield pairing for the state that City were in at that stage. And Sven came in, obviously Barton had gone with the incident with Ousmane Darbo, but Sven came in, looked at Michael Johnson, went, this kid can play. This kid can play, and he's going to play in my team.
Yeah, he didn't have any qualms about sticking him straight in, did he? So he obviously saw enough in training. He did have one complaint that he said he wasn't able to train enough with a groin injury, and we know it's much documented his fitness issues. And that's just when you've got a player of Sven's caliber who's managed the players he managed at that time, to be able to pin it on a young Mancunian lad and say, here you go, you're in my team alongside Alano in that midfield. It's a great boost for him, and he really took it well. The stats didn't really show too great, but we're watching his performance as a fellow City fan, a fellow Mancunian who is on the pitch doing the job that we'd love to do, and we were just in awe of him for that, certainly that season. When you mention this season, he's the first person I think of.
We've said a couple of times people have called him the next Colin Bell. We heard it from Jonathan Pearce in the commentary there as well. Could he have been?
Yeah, I believe so. I was never obviously able to watch Colin Bell, but my dad used to relay and compare the two. The way he'd receive the ball, pass it and move and go again, it was just, we'd not seen something like that, certainly from an English talent in our team. It was so exciting to watch, and I'm very guilty of getting on board with the hype of young English players. And I really thought we had the next big thing then. How long we would have been able to keep him for if he kept that form would be another question. But I've certainly bought into the Michael Johnson hype.
Right, well, it's time to have that debate now. While we're talking about how good City were in the first half of the season, a big part of that was Alano, but his form tailed off towards the end of the season. We have to start, though, Adam, with this moment.
Free kick to Manchester City. Alano over it, goes for goal! And scores the goal! Oh, that's superb! It's his first goal for Manchester City. He's shown what an exciting player he is in every other aspect of the game. Now he's shown he can finish too, and in style. Brazilian magic from the magician. It couldn't have gone in a better place. Impossible to save. Shea Given saw it, hurled himself at it, couldn't get close to it.
So that's Alano scoring his first goal for City, a free kick against Newcastle. When I say Alano, is that the first thing that springs to mind?
Yeah. Yeah, I had that down for a time as the best goal at the Etihad. Obviously, Vincent Kompany's goal against Leicester and Sergio's title winner aside, it was one of the best free kicks I'd ever seen. Perfect postage stamp, Shea Given no chance. And he was just really instrumental to our early season form there. He was unlike anything we'd had in that kind of maestro role. He just was a real good link with Michael Johnson, as we've alluded to. He was able to reverse pass. There was almost telepathic understanding between those two in the centre of midfield there. And that there was a few home wins in a row where he'd scored the goals in three of them that really, you know, elevated us to that next level. And I keep going on about that revolution. And he certainly was a big part of that at the early start of Sven's reign.
I have to ask this question now. Great player or fair weather player?
A great fair weather player.
no offense sitting here, mate.
No, I'm certainly in the Alano camp. I know I'm probably in the minority there. I think he's definitely what we needed. I was for the bits of, you know, intelligence and creativity that he provided. I'm happy for him to sit out a few games. There was a famous one away at Portsmouth where Bellamy called him out on it, him and Rubinho, I believe. But I've only got fond memories of Alano. Where do you stand?
I'm not quite there, I'm afraid. I remember him very fondly for what he did at the start of that season and for bits of things he did under Mark Hughes the next season. But there was a lot. There were long spells where he was anonymous in games, and it wasn't. I don't want to say that he wasn't trying, because I don't like to put that on players that they're not putting the effort in. And also, you can't question his commitment, because he was prepared to play right back at times when City didn't have a right back. So yeah. he was prepared to do that. I just wonder if it's very, very cliche to say, but did the conditions in the middle of winter and, you know, through the springtime didn't really suit his play?
Yeah, and I think there were some frustrations that when he'd play for Brazil whilst playing for us, he had some great games for Brazil as well. So I think some people were wondering where that form was for us. Did he come to us from Ukraine?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about the winters are a bit worse there, so I don't know whether he was using that to hide behind. But I've only got fond memories of him. Being, as if we call it inconsistent, then didn't really cost us too much, enough for him to damage his reputation with me.
Okay, I'll take that. The other thing is as well, the thought occurred to me, maybe we remember him fondly because he was the first spark after years of dull football.
Yes, exactly. That's what I alluded to there. That's exactly it. He was the first maestro we had probably since King Kladze. I hope I'm not doing anyone a disservice.
Benabia, mate. Benabia.
Yeah, sorry, exactly. I'm only counting top tier there. And Berkovic as well. Yeah, certainly since those type of plays, like you say, one spark and then his reputation's done then. He can do no wrong there after, for some fans, including myself on that one, I have to admit.
Right, well, for the younger fans listening, it's important that we say at this point that City didn't often beat United. Those growing up watching City now see a team that has no fear going to Old Trafford, and winning home and away against them is something that's not that unusual. Guardiola's done it, Pellegrini did it, Mancini did it, but in 2008, Sven became the first City manager to do it in 38 years. I'm talking about a Manchester Derby double. The first Manchester Derby that season came third in the fixture list, and City just about edged it somehow 1-0. Here's Sven again speaking to the podcast about that Derby.
I wished at that time that we had more times to prepare things, and that we didn't, well, it was more or less every day it came a new player. But anyhow, the players were very clever and very good football players, so we started the season very well, and better than I thought we should have, and better than anyone thought, I guess.
Now, that Manchester Derby, the first one at home at Eastlands, how did that differ to different derbies that you've managed in around the world?
Well, of course, it was my first derby in Manchester, and you could feel it the whole week before that this is something special. And I remember when I signed for City, one of the supporters came to me and said, "Sven, don't talk about Europe or the league or whatever it is. Just beat Manchester United twice, and that's it," he said. "That's the most important." It's important, of course it's important, but the most important, of course, is the final result for the club. You could feel the derby, and if you compare it with Lisbon or Rome or where I've been before, it's great. Probably it's the biggest derby I've been involved in.
Check out exclusive City interviews on our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
I don't know about you, Adam, I just remember that game. I think Tevez missed an open goal near the end, and everything was just really tense.
Yeah, and I remember Micah Richards being colossal that game. Him and Tevez had an epic battle that day. I think Rooney and Richard Dunn had a bit of a to-do as well, and everything seemed to go right for us that day, and we needed it. Giovanni scored after about 30 minutes, I think. Kidd might have took a slight deflection off Ferdinand. But then, you know, we were suddenly scoring home goals, which was a relief. And then to be able to lay down a marker so early in the season in a derby, Sven's stock was just rising. These whole new players that could never play together and didn't even know each other's name had just beaten United. You know, things were really looking up. We hadn't conceded a goal. I know we're only three games in the season, but Schmeichel was looking solid between the sticks as well.
He was only about 12, wasn't
he? Yeah, exactly. We'd thrown him in. I'm assuming Isaacson was injured, and that's why the decision was made.
Both Hart and Isaacson were injured at the start of the season.
So it was a kind of necessary decision. And we were scoring goals. We weren't conceding any, which was novel for City at that time. And that's probably why we were all a bit giddy at the start of that season, and certainly for that derby result.
Yeah, and then the second Manchester derby of the season also marked the 50th anniversary of the Munich air disaster. So this is what Sven remembers of that day.
Well, it was a special game because it was Memorial Day for the tragic air accident for Manchester United. So in that way, it was very, very special. And I will always remember in all my life the minutes before the kickoff, when it was 1 minute silence. And I remember during all the week, some of the people from City, they were nervous that City fans would boo them or something like that. And I think it was a great 1 minute of civilization and education, or whatever you say. You couldn't hear anything at the stadium for the whole minute, and that's one of these moments you're getting very, very proud of the club you work for and the fans you were working for. Very, very proud. It was great.
What do you remember of the game itself?
Well, I think we were not lucky. We were very good. We deserved to win that game. If you talk about the first game at home, we played okay, we played good, we won. But the second game, I think we were brilliant and we deserved to beat United at that time. At home, we played good, but not as good as we did away. Away was a very, very good football game.
And do you think with everything surrounding the game, with the 50th anniversary of the Munich disaster, do you think that that kind of took the focus off City, or did it put more pressure on City indeed?
No, I don't think that was good or bad for that game, for any team. I mean, you remember and you honour what happened. That was a terrible accident at that time, of course. So I think everyone was very happy to be there in this moment and staying there with the flowers. And it was very nice. And the 1 minute, as I said, was fantastic. And then, you know, when the game starts, you are totally focused on the 90 minutes you have ahead of you, if you are a player, a coach, a manager, whatever you are. So I think that's nothing to do with what happened in the game. The game was a brilliant game from Manchester City's side.
Now, you were the first manager to win a Manchester Derby double for City since 1969-70. So how did that feel?
It feels good. Of course, it still feels good that you know that we did it. And yeah, great. Of course, great during the game, great after the games. And well, it's there. It's written in the books. So whatever happened, I can't take that away from anyone who were involved at that time.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
I don't know about you, Adam, but the build-up to that second derby was... It almost felt like City were a sideshow in it all.
Yeah, with the only impact that City had in terms of the build-up with that was how misbehaved our fans were going to be.
And then they weren't. And
how disrespectful we were going to be because of the anniversary that it marked. And we were actually impeccable that day. Both sides still... deserve a mention. The fans came together for for that occasion and observed it impeccably. And I think, to be fair to United, the occasion got to them and we played the match. And it's almost poetic that we should win our first game at Old Trafford on their big day. Once the ceremony had finished, we needed to. You know, the football took centre stage.
And City were brilliant that day. I remember City being brilliant that day.
Yeah, we fought for every ball. We played well. We had the old retro kits on both teams, so it was kind of a novel game as well. And we played some good stuff, and we deserved it. They had nothing until the last few moments when Carrick scored, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if you did. You manage to get to that game or not?
No, but I was tuned in on the radio, so I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
Yeah, me too. I was
texting.
There was a point I remember very distinctly saying to my dad at one point, "Dad, do you think they're going to do this?" And he said, "Yeah, they'll do it now," because it was like 92 minutes or something like that. And even at 92 minutes, I was still thinking, "Just blow the whistle, referee, blow it up." And it was still 2-0. And then I think Darren Fletcher?
I thought it was Carrick that scored.
Might have been Michael Carrick, actually. Yeah. I can't remember if Fletcher played for them at that stage or not.
No, I just remember thinking, is it real? You know, this is so new, like you say, to City fans of a certain age. That was unheard of for us to go to Old Trafford, and certainly to do a double. Let's not forget, like you mentioned, it was a league double for the first time in God knows.
It's 38 years. 38 years. That City hadn't been to Old Trafford and won the same season as they won at home. Let's have a listen to the goals. We can't not have a listen to the goals.
Petrov tries to slide it through. Ireland! And Vassell! Saved by Van der Sar. Vassell again scores. Manchester City have upset the form book by taking the lead at Old Trafford, and it's Darius Vassell.
And touched on it in! Benjani on his debut! Scores in the Manchester derby.
Second goal courtesy of Benjani's head, allegedly. What did you think of Benjani when they signed him, Adam?
Well, there was the bizarre transfer story of him falling asleep at the airport and missing deadlines and then it getting over the line. I know Harry Redknapp recalls that.
Slightly differently. Well, I'll tell you what, let's have a listen to Harry Redknapp because he gives his side of the story to BetSafe's YouTube channel.
He'd done well for me in the end. He scored the goal at Wigan that kept us up that year, and I think that was the only goal he got that season. The following year, he started to bang a few goals in, but he was, as I say, a real worker. Suddenly Sven came on and offered me £9 million for him, and it was a fantastic offer. Benji didn't want to go. I wanted to sell him. I thought it was... certainly over the price that he was really worth. and but he got to Southampton Airport and missed two planes. And eventually I had to drag him on the runway to push him onto a plane and kept telling him what a great move it was to go to Man City. He got here, I think, about 11 o'clock at night. They rushed him. It was transfer deadline night. They rushed him to the stadium. Somehow, don't ask me how, they got the paperwork through, and I was sitting there praying at the other end that it would go through.
You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
We should correct one thing that he said there. Is in typical Redknapp fashion, Redknapp claims it was £9 million for the transfer. It wasn't £9 million. It was £9 million if you include the add-ons. up front, it was roughly £4 million. I don't know. What do you believe, Adam? Because there's also the story that City tried to stop the deal, even though it had gone through.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre transfer, such a City transfer, especially typical of that season. You know, the transfer dealings there. You know, who was organising them? You've got Portsmouth shoving him out the door, saying you are going to the airport, you are going to City. Him allegedly saying he doesn't want to. Us saying we don't want him. And then he goes and scores the winner in the derby. What a calamity and a comedy of errors that's just typical of that time and our approach. And like I say, almost poetic that we get a derby double. And it's the guy who, is he coming, isn't he coming, falling asleep and putting, you know, past the midnight deadline, and he signs on a deadline day and scores on derby day.
Well, that was it. I mean, like, Portsmouth at that stage were trying to get rid of him. City were desperate to sign him because they wanted a striker.
Yeah.
And then the deadline passed. Portsmouth weren't sure if they'd received the paperwork for him. City were adamant that they'd sent it. They kind of then slept on it, decided that they didn't want him anymore, and tried to claim that they hadn't sent the paperwork in time, at which point Portsmouth said, no, we've received it. And I can't, like, honestly.
Typical.
It almost summed up the second half of that season for me, because the second half of that season, after the Manchester derby double, that was the only real highlight in what was a pretty poor second half. City only won five games after the midway point. One of them was at home to Spurs, where Nedimon Nuah scored his first ever goal. Here he is talking about that goal to the podcast.
Yeah, it was against Spurs, and I think it was, I'm not sure if it was the first goal or the second goal. I remember Stephen Allen scored as well. And I got to a stage where I thought, I'm just never going to score, to be honest. I thought it was going to be, I think it was Klaas Lundekvam and stuff that was at Southampton, just went through his entire career basically without scoring. But the cross came in, inch perfect, just powered the header out, and then did a little embarrassing celebration towards my family. Yeah, this seems the way first goal should be.
I say you were blowing kisses, if I remember.
That's exactly right. You have a very good memory. I was blowing kisses all over the place. I don't even, to be honest, I thought I was doing it towards my family, but they were probably in a different side of the stand. It was just short, so much was the emotion.
Please support the show by becoming a backer. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Again, though, that was a rare good day. City had been knocked out of the FA Cup by lower league Sheffield United at Bramall Lane as well. That was when balloons caused a problem in the goal mouth.
Thought they were lacking a little bit of support. It looked a nothing ball, but yes, it might have hit a balloon. But a balloon's not going to deviate the ball. It's not going to divert it anywhere. It hits two balloons. I'm sure it's put Michael Ball off. Just visually. Because it rocks two. First a blue one there, then a white one just behind it. And he just makes a complete and utter mess of it.
I was there for that one. Couldn't believe it. It's one of those things in hindsight you're probably thinking, right, clear the balloon.
Pop the balloons. Yeah, what are you doing, man?
You'd think it's not going to do any harm, but now, obviously, that's the first thing anyone will do now when it comes on a balloon in the goal mouth. But I keep going on about a typical season. Luckily, it seems we've shelved that tag recently, but back then, anything that could go wrong did go wrong. Even with these new resources, even with this new revolution, even with this new outlook, even with so many new resources, and a balloon knocks us out of the FA Cup. You know, we're a laughing stock for so long, but it's definitely character building.
Do you remember who scored his first goal for City that day?
Oh, now you're putting me on the spot. I'm saying, why do I want to say Stephen Ireland? But I'm not sure if it
wasn't Stephen Ireland. No, he'd scored already by that. Daniel Sturridge. Daniel Sturridge scored for City. He came on as a sub in the second half. That was when Sven made the bold move of subbing Alano at half time because it just wasn't working. And Sturridge came on and rattled one in off the bar. Then did this daft dance. And it's nice to see that these days he's grown up. None of these daft celebrations. It's funny, but like you talk about City, like City weren't knocked out of the FA Cup by a balloon. They were knocked out by a Sheffield United side that played really well on the day. it almost kind of summed up City's second half of the season. When the going got tough, they couldn't really do it.
Yeah, I remember. So if we start the second half of that season, we went away to Newcastle and won. And we went up to fourth after that game. And I remember texting into the radio saying, we're all going on a European tour, and it got read out. And I was thinking, we'd hit the heights that I'd not seen in our supporting, obviously supporting City. My first game was in 95. So we'd not seen these type of fourth in the Premier League after Christmas. And then it absolutely just nosedived, absolutely fell off a cliff after that. Was it a case of us doing all the hard work in the first half of the season and resting on our laurels, thinking we'd done enough?
There was some pretty bad luck at times as well. I remember going to Birmingham and Sun Ji-hai conceded a penalty when Gary McSheffrey shoulder charged him. And then Sun Ji-hai just stood his ground. Gary McSheffrey bounced off him and the referee pointed to the spot. And it's like little things like that where I just remember this look on Sun Ji-hai's face. He put his hands on his head and just started laughing because it was that ridiculous.
Yeah, it just seemed like anything that was going to go against us was going to. Was that the 3-1?
Yeah, Alano scored.
My mate Alano scored, yeah.
City also lost Richard Dunn to injury at Reading. And at that point, the defence was being held together by sticky tape. And I think we already mentioned Alano playing right back at a time, but for a time they were playing four fullbacks as across the back. They were playing Javier Garrido, Michael Ball, veteran Chorluka, either Anua or Richards. It was just, I think Anua dislocated his shoulder at one point as well. There's just so much going wrong.
Yeah, so. Obviously, you've got the early season form that we never quite reached. Then you've got all those injuries and the bad luck that we mentioned. And it's almost a tale of two seasons in one season. You know, you could almost be forgiven for thinking that they were two separate seasons in terms of that fortune. I remember a win at Sunderland away and a home win at Portsmouth were the only things to really celebrate after that derby win.
Yeah, I forgot the Sunderland goal because Darius Vassell. I remember
he had a famous quote. He said he went to break the net even though it trickled over the line.
Yeah, he said it to Match of the Day because I've been trying to find it for years.
Whenever
we do features about good luck or good fortune or flukes, because he said something like, "I tried to take the back of the net off, but I nearly broke my foot off."
Yes. You know, we needed that result at that time. You know, we were on the back of a couple of losses there. Like I say, it almost nosedived off a cliff. And we just needed a few more wins just to perk us up a bit at that stage. It was looking quite grey for a time.
And speaking of Richard Dunn, do you remember the final home game of 2007? I think it might be New Year's Eve. They played Liverpool. It drew 0-0.
Yeah.
And Fernando Torres was on fire, but Richard Dunn was tackled him about 10 or 12 times out of nowhere.
If you asked me for Dunn's best game, I'd probably say that one, bizarrely.
He cleared off the line as well, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And we really matched that. When I keep saying about these levels that we went up, Liverpool were a great side then, or certainly a good side then. And we matched them. And that's when I was looking around thinking we could probably achieve something here this season. Obviously, I didn't know what was about to come, but around that time, I really thought the performances we were putting in were matching, you know, we're matching these teams where we could only have dreamt of the season before when we couldn't even score a goal.
Yeah, well, as things were going through April and May, they're just beginning to get worse and worse. News leaked from behind the scenes that Sven was to be sacked at the end of the season. Here's how the manager remembers it.
We dropped a little bit in form, that's for sure. Or maybe it's more normal. I think Christmas time we were second in the league at a certain point for rather a long time, if I don't remember badly. I think we were very good. I don't think we were as good as we could keep a second place for the rest of the season. That was one reason. Another reason, at the end of the season, it became too many rumors about my future in the club and my relationship, but Texan's relationship with me was totally broken down. He never talked to me. He didn't want to talk to me the last couple of months. And of course, players knew that. And the whole ambient became, from being great, it became not bad, but it became, well, I think everyone was at that time a little bit disappointed of what was happening. not on the pitch, but off the pitch.
Well, I was going to say, what was it like managing the team, knowing that the chairman intended to sack you at the end of the season? That must have been very difficult for you.
Well, you have to try to do the best you can, but it wouldn't have been a problem if only I knew about it, or I didn't know about it, but I was rather sure that would happen. But as soon as it comes out to other people in the club and the players and the staff, and at the end the fans knew it as well, or they suspected it, then it becomes very difficult. And I think for everyone, and I think it's very, very normal that it shouldn't have happened, that came out. I think the Thai people at that time with Dr. Texan, he could have sacked me at the end of the season, but he should never have letting us suspect that would happen. That was his great mistake. So I take the blame for the last games of the season, but I think he should take equal blame of it, because as a football director, you can't act like that.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast, facebook.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Adam, when you hear that, what does it make you think about, Sven?
Well, he endeared himself to the fans from day one. There was that tongue-in-cheek song about him being able to, enjoy people's wives on their settee if he took us to Wembley. So, it obviously made a place in our hearts. I thought, obviously, looking back at the results now, it doesn't make good reading for that second half, but I think he did such a good job for where we were at that time. And, you know, the fans were up in arms. There was posters printed, stickers printed, save our Sven.
Were you a Sven campaigner?
Yeah, I was, yeah, at the time. Were you not?
I was on the fence about it, because I was very much... It's what he brought to City in the first half of the season was fantastic, and it had lifted the mood brilliantly. It was so needed at that stage. But the second half of the season was just relegation form, and I couldn't see how he would change that for the start of the next season. I couldn't see what he was doing, because he'd said around about Christmas that he was worried that other teams had figured out how to play against City, and then he hadn't changed anything.
Yeah, true. So that obviously goes then again to that, what we were wondering what happened in that second half of the season. So then you add that into the mix that he only have one way and people found out how to play against us. And the fact that he admitted that and then still didn't change it does make you wonder whether the correct decision was made. But I certainly think the majority of City fans who started that movement were certainly in. He was a great guy. The players loved him. And it was quite a shock that his head was even going to be called for at the end of that season, because it gave us some good football for what we were at that time. And I was certainly in the Save Our Sven group, definitely.
Yeah, he, as a mark of how much of a gentleman that man was, though, even though he knew he'd been sacked, he carried on managing the team, and then even after the season, took them on a post-season tour of Thailand to promote the club in the home country of the chairman, who was on the run and had already sacked him.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's a great anecdote.
It just shows he's a perfect gentleman.
Yeah, he didn't leave any with any bad bad taste in the air. You know, he conducted himself as a gentleman, like you say. And knowing what he knew and still carried on. Obviously, the 8-1 horrendous game at Middlesbrough was a reflection of that, but. I was gutted to see him go, and I accept your point there. What would he have done in the next season? That would have been an interesting one, but we obviously weren't, as a club, willing to see what he would have done in another season.
Yeah, well, you mentioned it there. It all culminated in this on the final day of the season.
Tonchai has timed his run to perfection there. He's onside. Was he hauled down? Penalty is given, and this could be a red card for Richard Dunn. Tonchai timed his run to perfection. Dunn brought him down. Dunn is recorded. Downing to take this penalty against Andreas Isaksson. No doubt about it. Wonderful finish on the penalty spot. Clinical 1-0 to Middlesbrough. Welcome back, Stillwell. They skip away from the challenges. Alves! That's a great goal for Middlesbrough. 2-0. The Brazilian strikes again. Now Boateng. Going towards Alves and Sunshine again, causing problems. Oh, that is incredible! That is a fabulous finish. Stuart Downing, who may just have finished Sven and Manchester City off. Alves is through the middle here. He's onside. It could be and should be 4-0 to Middlesbrough. It's a rout. It just crept in. Two for Alves, four for Middlesbrough. They are running riot at the Riverside. More here. It is. It's five for Middlesbrough. Took a deflection. It is an absolute rout. It is Fabio Rockenbach. Plenty of power. That is another tremendous goal. How about that? 6-0. There's Ali Adiera. Could be seven. It just gets better and better for Middlesbrough. It's a nightmare for Manchester City. It's 7-0. There's Alano. Oh, look at that. A response from Manchester City. Too little, too late. But what another fabulous goal. It's Alves for a hat-trick. It's 8 for Middlesbrough. It's a hat-trick for Afonso Alves. Embarrassment for City. Pure, unbridled joy for Middlesbrough. If Sven is to be forced out, then he signs off with his team given an absolute beating. It'll be a sad way for him to bow out as Manchester City manager. It's finished at the Riverside Stadium, a breathless Riverside Stadium. Middlesbrough 8, Manchester City 1.
So 8 goals for Middlesbrough, 1 for City. And
my mate.
Like, yeah, your mate again. Do you think, I can't decide on this one, was this a player protest on the day or was City just out of ideas, out of luck, just everything going wrong for them?
I'd like to think the reason we were so bad is because the players decided they were down in tools, but I don't think professionalism would have let them. I think we were just, it was a dead rubber. We were our highest league position in the Premier League, well, you know, for a long while. And I almost think, so I keep alluding to this, part of that season was almost job done, like very early on. And because we were just glad of anything at that point, that's why I think like the job was done earlier in the season. That game was just an epitome of that, of just, I just remember watching the scores come in at the bottom, because we weren't the live game, but the scores just kept scrolling at the bottom. It just kept coming and coming, and I was like, that. You know, I'd like to think it was a player protest, but I don't think professionalism would have allowed for that. But,
yeah, to be fair, when I went back and watched that to make that compilation there, it was like watching a goal of the season compilation. The quality of Middlesbrough's goals that day were ridiculous. I just felt sorry for Isaacson.
Yeah, exactly. That makes me feel a bit better than if we were absolutely mullered from, you know.
Oh, don't get me wrong. City were horrendous as well. But yeah. It just so happened that everything Middlesbrough hit seems to go in though. I met like Fabio Rockenbach's free kick was like 35 yards out in off the bar. Stuart Downing with an outside of the foot volley into the far post. Like so many like things that just shouldn't happen.
Yeah. It's one of those games, but we'll still remember it. It's, you know, a massive, massive defeat. Obviously, you've got Sven's last game in charge. It was Isaacson's last game. Sunjai's last game. You know, we didn't know then that was going to be their last games. It's just a really end of an era, and it really, what was such a rubbish curtain, you know, to bring the curtain down on a season in such a way that it just was typical of what was the decisions that were being made behind in the background that was going to culminate in his sacking. It was just almost typical to be emphatically, you know, trashed at Middlesbrough.
Middlesbrough, by the way, had not scored more than 2 goals in a league game all season.
Yeah, exactly. Well, those
8 goals were nearly a third of Middlesbrough's home goals for the whole season. And because City lost that game, and because like, this is one of the reasons why I hope this season that we're currently in the middle of now doesn't get scrubbed, because City are the only team to have scored 8 in one Premier League game and conceded 8 in a different one. Because of that Middlesbrough game.
I like that.
So yeah. Throughout the second half of that season, Taksin Sinawatra was on the run, as we mentioned, from the Thai authorities. He was accused of human rights abuses by Amnesty International, and his assets were being frozen, which meant he wasn't able to pay for the players and their wages like he'd promised. He did, though, appoint Gary Cook as chief executive. Here's the former CEO speaking to the podcast about what his relationship with the chairman was like.
If you look at all of the clubs in the world, particularly in England, this one I felt was a sleeping giant. I felt that you always have to have confidence in your own ability. There was an element of it where I knew I was in at the deep end, But I really felt there was something there at Man City that could be quite extraordinary.
You mentioned there John Wardle and the impact he had. There were rumours that his money was needed to pay the players at one stage. How true were they?
They were very true. You know, we were in dire straits. You know, we were shortly about to go into administration. There was a big challenge ahead, and John is a City fan through and through, and I've been public with this before, is that if it wasn't for John, I think we would have been in a much worse situation. And who knows, once you lose control and a football club goes into the hands of administrators, it can be very challenging.
So what was it then that you saw that kind of revolutionised the club and changed it to make sure it didn't fall into administration?
Well, we quite simply, we had to go out and find new owners, and within 10 days, you know, some of the guys that were working with Shannon Thaksin Shinawatra were posed the question, we're going to have to find some funds. You know, Thaksin was having some challenges politically, and it was impacting the football club. And we then had to go and try and sell the football club. And we spoke to, you know, Greek shipping tycoons, and we spoke to a few different guys. And, you know, the wind came blowing through, and we were in the right direction when we made contact with the guys from Abu Dhabi.
What was your impressions of Dr. Thaksin Shinawatra?
You know, I of course, everybody remembers, you know, my comments about seemed like a nice guy, and I suppose that if you look at that in the context of some of the issues that he's faced, I would say that's probably a naive thing to say from me. But you can only judge people on the face value of what you experience, and I didn't have a political platform. I don't have a political platform, and I wasn't interested in getting involved in politics. My job was to run the football club, and whenever I met with him and spoke to him, he would ask me for my thoughts. I would give them to him, and he would say, I support your views, away you go. And then when we sat down and discussed the fact that we needed to sell the football club, he said, okay, then I agree. So for me, my experience with him was one of, it was cordial, it was sensible, and it was adult. But you know, I wasn't interested in his political background.
Please give us your backing. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Gary Cook speaking about Thaksin Shinawatra there. When you think about the assets being frozen, Adam, were you worried at that stage about the financial future of City?
Yeah, I thought he was going down and dragging us, would have dragged us down with him. You know, you've got to really wonder about the future of the club when you're being linked with these type of people and these type of frozen assets. I remember that being a big buzzword around that time. But it turns out getting Gary Cook in for the job that he did for us, off-field antics aside, he really... It was a masterstroke in getting Gary Cook in to negotiate future deals.
It kind of brings me on to the first Ask the Panel question, because Ben M on Twitter asks, does Thaksin deserve more credit for the role he played in City being where they are today?
Yeah, I think he does. I think I was convinced this guy could go down and take us with him. We could have been stripped of everything, you know, fire sale for, you know, it's not worth even considering what the future could have, you know, been. But I understand from a limited knowledge of that situation is that he actually ensured that we were sold, or his involvement with the club was a separate entity from his activity, and almost made sure we were looked after as he before he closed the door behind him and disappeared into the abyss. So I think we actually owe him a lot. I'm not an expert on the dealings, but I do believe that he could have took us down with us and actually obviously didn't, and look where we are now on the back of that.
Yeah, he said in interviews afterwards as well that owning a football club, he's not rich enough to own a football club. And I think he's still worth something like £500 million. So it's like, it kind of puts into perspective the debts that he took on at City there. When you consider that actually, you know, £500 million isn't a lot to go on these days.
There's talk recently that he was, I think it was as recently as last year, that he was looking to buy into someone like Crystal Palace.
Ah, well, he buried Crystals under our pitch, so he
I forgot to mention this actually earlier on, but he was very superstitious, wasn't he?
Yeah, he buried Crystals under the Etihad pitch to bring us luck. He gave us all free meals in Albert Square. He really endeared himself to the fans, and obviously City, anyone that was going to boost our fortune, City fans took to just as a messiah almost. And he educated us on some cultural things from Thailand. Obviously he had his human rights issues, so we can't paint him in too much of a glorious state, but he certainly educated us and gave us some food for thought.
Catherine O'Brien on the emails asks, what was the best goal scored by City that season? And
you're
going to talk about Alano at Newcastle again.
Yeah.
Alano at Borough was the best goal of the game, even though it was the one in the 8-1. We haven't mentioned Stephen Ireland against Reading.
Great stuff.
Volley in the 94th minute.
And would won every home game up until that point, and that was going to break that run if he didn't do that in that last minute. I'm going for Alano free kick. I'd not seen anything like that in a long time, and not a long time since. It was just perfect for me, but Stephen Ireland deserves a mention.
I'm taking Stephen Ireland's goal because it was an incredible volley that I don't know how he did it. finally, Ben Aspinall on the email says, given the comments made by past England players, do you feel Sven's one-dimensional system and tactics were his undoing at City? Given the players he had at his disposal, they should have finished a lot higher than ninth.
Yeah, I think we alluded to that as well. I've learnt that he believed that other teams may have found him out and he didn't do anything about that. That might be all right in tournament football when you may only play a team once, whereas when you're playing them home and away across the season, you've got to have multiple ways of unlocking them and outthinking them. And obviously, it turned out he was very one-dimensional. I think, like you alluded to, David, his biggest masterstroke of the season was taking Alano off at half-time. And that was seen as a maverick move. So I think that was his undoing, and ultimately, that's why the decision was made.
I think it's very easy to remember how badly that season ended. So I want to finish this week's show on some of the positives that it did, because it did bring City fans a fresh taste of good football after years of simply existing, didn't it?
Yeah, I think we keep harping back to that early form. We've done a league double over United for the first time. There was it only took us six games at home to score the same amount that we had the previous season. So anything is going to be good. There was those games against Middlesbrough and Birmingham at home where we were just on this run of winning and playing good football at home that was alien to us at that time. We had the emergence of Johnson, Alano being our top scorer with 10, a striker that dared to get double figures, not even a striker, but a player that dared to get double figures for us for a season. We were really reaching new heights, and that revolution was just rolling on, and we had reason to be optimistic. We didn't know it was going to fall off, but certainly I hold that season in high regard in terms of what it brought to us, and it kind of was preparing us for what was to come. We kind of were able to have a little seat at the top table, even if it was just a temporary one, an emergency chair.
Yeah, I mean, it also at that time, it was the first ever time in the Premier League where City had an entire season where they were in the top 10 at all times. They were never in the bottom half of the Premier League table, and that's the first time that had ever happened.
See, that's why he should have got another season. yeah, the first time ever in the Premier League that we didn't drop out of the top 10, that was unheard of for us in our yo-yo form then. It's just, I think that's what, kind of looking back now at that season, we almost thought the job was done because we were achieving things that we hadn't, although they weren't great on the grand scale of things. For us, it was a good season. I only ever look at that season and think of it with happy memories. Get rid of that 8-1 defeat at the end of it, and it's an all right season for us.
And they qualified for Europe in the end. It was via the Fair Play League, but they got in there in the end.
Exactly. So I was right in the January when I was texting TalkSport saying we're going on a European tour.
Right. Well, that's it for this week's trip down memory lane. Thank you very much for listening to the show. If you've enjoyed it, then please help us out by giving it a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you've listened to it. You can also get a little bit of extra podcast by listening to our Patreon bonus
show. That's available for $2 a month. Backers at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. This week's show is all about bogey teams. So special thanks to my guest, Adam Carter.
Thank you.
And given how the season ended in the stands with the fans singing, "We don't need no Phil Scolari, we don't need no Mourinho, hey, Taxin, leave our Sven alone," there's only one way we can finish today's show. See you next week.
We don't need no.
Was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.